You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm speaking to Esther Manito. She's fantastic. I saw her show Not All Men at Edinburgh this year. And it was one of those shows that I found myself recommending to loads and loads of people, particularly men, particularly married men. She is incredibly relatable in her comedy. And if you know the territory, I would suggest it is even finer still. So really, really good fun talking to her. And we're going to talk about whether you can be too relatable. We're going to be talking about the material that is rooted in the clash between her Middle Eastern heritage and her Essex upbringing. And we're going to talk a little bit about an agent's misguided warning that people don't want a comedy mum. Maybe what people want is a comedy mum. There's 15 minutes of extras available exclusively to the Insiders Club, including more from Esther on her generalised anxiety disorder, and she lets us in on the very worst gig of her life. All of that is at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. For now, this is Esther Manito. Welcome to the show, Esther Manito.
Hello.
Lovely to have you. We've got to do the fake start thing. Can we just finish our lovely conversation we were having about running before your mic went wonky? You ran for the Chingford Harriers.
I ran for the
I've mixed up two. Is that right?
No.
Chingford Harriers, was that? No, right?
No, it was called the Orion Harriers. So yeah, they were okay. In Chingford. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Used to run
with them.
For a running club mean?
Just means you meet up every week and you run. And occasionally you'll do races and then you might like compete against other running clubs. And it meant like when you did bigger runs and they were like, you affiliated with a club, you could then say, yes, I'm affiliated with that club. And then those running points would go towards that club. So I used to run with them, ran for East London Runners for a little bit. That was back in that was pre-kids when I had time to do long runs. And then since having kids, I think I've only done like one half marathon, but I now just do short runs every day.
Okay, got it. So that when you run with an organisation, that to me starts to smell like a sport.
No, it wasn't like that. It was like, the men would treat it like that. So you'd always have the guy. So they used to have like leaders for your runs. So you do like trail runs. We used to even do like night runs with head torches through the forest. Yeah. And when the women ran together, we would just be like chat, chat, chat. All lovely. But when the guys got involved, they'd always be like, I'm going to talk to you about your form. We're going to aim for times. And you'd just be like, oh, can you fuck off, Gary? Because I just want to jog through the forest. It was lovely.
And running is something I associate with robust mental health. I've started saying that. It's become a catchphrase on the podcast now, describing mental health as robust or less robust. You mentioned before that you were kind of, I've got to keep running or I go mental.
Yeah, just got to keep
running. I don't want to misquote
you. No, that's exactly the right quote. Just got to run, otherwise I go mad. Even in Edinburgh, I had to do exercise. I was either like, it was either a hike or a run or a swim. And then the last week was kind of like my fuck it moment. And I didn't really exercise that much. I was eating rubbish. And by the time I got to the end of that final week, I was like, yeah, just want to step in front of a moving car. I'm so
I noticed a tweet you did at the time, which was something like, I'm done. now I'm just going to go and lie down and do nothing and then go to Asda. And I thought, that's your classic Esther Manito take. I'm exhausted. I need a bit of me time, but I've got responsibilities. Thank you. That seems very you.
It is like that, though. You know, like other people, like, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to chill out. And I'm like, fuck off. I've got to go do the big shop.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. But then in a way, you kind of relish it because it's humbling. And I do think, because you've got kids, I do think, like, we're quite lucky and that we, when, if you don't have anything, and that's what Edinburgh does, is you come home from your gig and you're just still in that bubble and you can be as self-absorbed in it and you can think about it and you can analyse it. Whereas when you've got shit outside, you come home and you've got that journey home to obsess about it. And then the moment you get through the front door, it's like, no one cares. No one cares about your little performance. No one's interested. Yes. Get the dinner on.
I experienced a meta version of that this year when I was at the festival for a week, just the first week, and then I left and to do a family summer. And that's completely, I mean, I've done nearly 30 Edinburgh festivals and I've never not been there when it's been happening. And what I realised was there's a similar thing going on whereby I realised that the rest of the world doesn't give a shit about Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Like, not just not my family.
Yeah.
They certainly don't give a shit about Edinburgh. No. But the world at large. I always assumed that when we were all at Edinburgh, the rest of the world was fixated on it and reading the reviews and watching the stuff. There's nothing. They don't give
it is. Choice. It's really humbling. Like, you come back from Edinburgh and you literally get off at King's Cross Station and you're like, oh, no one cares. It's insane. It's insane because you've just spent a month going, I'm pooing four times a day. I'm just racked with nerves. I'm waiting for that review to come out because when that review comes out, it'll be read in Parliament. Everyone I've ever known, my old home ec teacher, everyone's going to know that I am this, what that review says. And then you come back from Edinburgh and it's like, sorry, who are you? No one cares. Which is really important.
And it's the classic thing of like a parent sending you a 3-star review thinking that's good. And you go, actually, initially that's like quite painful. You didn't want to see it. You got excited because someone sent you a review and then you see it. You're like, oh, for Christ's sake. But actually, the deeper meaning behind that is that the world doesn't know or care. If everyone thinks a 3-star review is good, that's great. That's the outside world.
I got in trouble once for sharing my 3-star reviews.
Did you? Yeah. Like, in trouble with, like, management or other comments? Someone was like, don't do that. Really?
Because it was my debut and they were nice reviews. And I put them on my Facebook and I was like, but that's my friends and family. And they are saying nice things. So why can't I? And they were like, do you want everyone to think you're having a shit Edinburgh? And I was like, I didn't know I was. I thought I was having a nice time.
So your debut was 2019?
Yeah.
2018? 2019? 2019. So you're... There are two kind of contextual issues before we get into the meat of it. One is, I don't know how old your children are, did you become a comic when you were already a mum?
Yeah, I became a comic when my daughter was 2 and my son was 7 months.
For the benefit of the listener, I'm standing and saluting Esther Benito. That is, I think that's one of, I cannot it's imagine mental. Doing that. I can't imagine it.
And I really, really love it now. And I've said this on a couple of podcasts. I love it because now comedians are having babies. And I love it when I see broken people that I started with. And when I see them broken and they're like, how the fuck were you doing open mic nights? And I'm like, thank you. That's all I've ever wanted, because you were all carefree and single and having, you know, beers after gigs and stuff. And I was going home to breastfeed and get up at 4 a.m. So, yeah, thanks for appreciating it. So I'm really enjoying seeing all the, now my kids are like sleeping through the night and getting on with stuff. And now I'm seeing all these comics who are broken and I'm like, wah, wah.
before we kind of pursue that line, I said there were two things. What was the other contextual issue? Oh, the other one, just to mark it for later. The other one is you debuted and then the pandemic happened. So you have kind of grown up as a comic, not begun as a comic mid-pandemic. That's a whole different thing. But let's come back. I just want to kind of mark that later on. I want to come back to that. I've just done my debut. It went well. I'm registered as an entity in comedy. Oh, shit, it's all stopped. Let's come back to that. But just to pursue first, how and why... this is not a nuanced question by the standards of this podcast, but I do want to get into how you started comedy, particularly as someone who already had children, because that is... As you say, as you rightly say, you should be proud of it. That is an unbelievable... hill to climb, to start. And I say that as someone who starts
stupid like, one.
Well, so why then? Were you like a frustrated comic? Were you thinking, man, I've got to do this eventually? And then it happened. What's the kind of the beginnings of you in comedy?
No, I mean, I've always been pretty crap at everything I do. So I wasn't a brilliant... I was a teacher. I was a teacher on maternity leave. Two kids. Wasn't a great teacher. Terrible mother. But I did feel mentally frustrated. That was something I felt. And I think I was saying this to a friend of mine. She's trying to have kids at the moment. She was like, just be honest with me. What's it like? And I was like, honestly, you will never fall in love as hard as you fall in love with your children. It's insane. It's also really boring. Like when you're at home with babies, it's really boring because obviously they can't talk to you. So you do go a little bit. And I did feel just kind of like a bit kind of trapped in my head. So I started, my friend was doing a comedy course. So I was like, oh, I'll go and do that with her. But I never thought I'd do stand up. But I thought, you know, I'll do it once a week, go and do the course. And then that's just, you know, something for a few weeks that gets me out of the house every week. But I never thought, and I never told anyone. I never told my husband. I was like, I'm just going to go and do this. Like, I'm just going to meet friends or I'm just, you know, going to go and do a yoga class or whatever. But I never told anyone. I never thought in a million years I'd do stand up.
And did the course feel, or did the elements of the course which were live performing or any of it feel like a natural fit for you? Because one of the elements about you is that you're sort of a natural. It's very hard to imagine you doing something else.
Ah, that's very sweet of you.
No, because you're incompetent is what I mean. No, I can't just sit here and pay people compliments. Do you know what I mean? But
terrible.
Yes, no, do you mean like your kind of your connection with an audience and your ability to speak very honestly and kind of not lightly, casually, but you just kind of say what you're thinking and it's funny. You're one of those comics.
Oh, you're so very sweet.
Back to the question.
So was it natural?
Did it feel like a natural fit?
Yes and no. I definitely wasn't somebody, and I still don't. I'm not somebody who's confident. So I'm not someone who, when I see people who are like, yeah, let's go do this. Have a good one, guys. We're all going to have a great time. I'm like, who are you and what made you? Because I go to every single gig hoping that I die. Or the venue explodes, or something happens.
I'm hoping that you die before you, like you die on the way, so you don't have to do it.
I'm like, please don't make me get up on that stage. When I'm on the stage, I enjoy it, but I am not somebody who's. So when I first ever performed, I threw up through adrenaline.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's not something that was. It felt like, oh, she's such a naturally confident person, but I do enjoy it once I'm up there. If it's going well, obviously. We've all been there where it's not going well and you're like, oh, for the love of God, make this end. But yeah, it wasn't like a... It didn't feel like, oh yeah, this is just naturally me and I can just do this naturally without any kind of work.
So what kept you going back? Is this just a description of just how boring your home life was that you would go to the... presumably it was enjoyable even if it wasn't a natural fit. Was the course enjoyable?
Yes, it was. And it felt like it was just something really different. And I think sometimes you need just something a bit scary to shake things up a little bit. Like, you know, family life is absolutely brilliant. And I'm really, really, really happy that I had children before I started doing comedy. Really glad, because I can't imagine trying to juggle the two worlds, being an established comic and then trying to, I think that must be a really hard path to navigate for all sorts of different reasons. But it felt like it just felt really exciting to go and do something that was just yours and completely disconnected to home life. So that, I think, was the thing. And the fact that it was just, it felt really playful and just like messing around. And I never thought anything would come of it. So it felt just like this fun club that I'd go and do something, you know, like that once a week for a while.
And when was that? What kind of year are we talking? I'm just trying to bridge the gap between that and your debut.
2016.
Okay. So that's pretty quick. That's pretty no messing. Starts in 2016, debut 3 years later to a decent critical reception. That's quite quick.
Yeah. I don't know. Because people seem to debut after 5 minutes now. Like when I was up in,
unless they're tactically doing what I can't remember who told me this, the 40-minute, referring to it as the coward's hour. the tactical 40.
People seem to just waltz out the womb now and get straight on stage and do a debut, and I'm like, how have you got things to say?
Well, I think part of that is people are cottoning on faster and faster the extent to which the industry fetishizes youth.
Right.
So like, oh, if you're 18 and you are funny, oh my God, the vultures will circle. Like, yeah, we can work this person for 40 years. This is great, you know. I think that's maybe at the heart of it. But so tell me about the circuit then, and kind of what was the moment when you thought, actually, post-course, I'm going to do a gig and I'm going to sign up to a thing and I've got something here. Or not. I don't mean so structurally like that. I mean, kind of what was the first bit you did that you went, hey, this works, this is reliable and I enjoy doing it and it gets a laugh and it's me.
I think, God, I still do bits that I did back then that are still just like my go-to. Oh, if this isn't working, I'm just going to go to it. But I think anything, because everything I talk about is family related. And I think it was just, that's how I started. I literally started off talking about babies, probably. Obviously, now I've got older children, but at the time it was talking about babies, pregnancy, things like that. And I remember just getting a reaction from women that I was like, oh, I think, because I used to, before I started doing comedy, I would go down like to playgroup and I'd say things to other mums and I could just see there was mums who would like chuckle along. And then some mums like, did she just say that out loud? And I'm like, it is funny, but no one feels comfortable saying it. And yes, that's when I kind of cottoned on. I was like, if you say it, the mums will want to come and hear you say it because you're saying the shit that they know is socially unacceptable for them to say out loud.
Yes.
So that's when I started to think, oh, okay, there's a real relationship that I can have with women my age on stage.
Yes.
And dads to a certain extent, if they're okay.
Yeah, for
with
sure. I mean, your
mocked
show, the show I saw at Edinburgh just gone, #NotAllMen, there was some incredibly, that's one of your kind of superpowers, I think. One of your great strengths is how relatable you are. And I was saying, like, I would recommend that show to people on the basis of, like, it's kind of like there's loads of stuff about her and her husband that it's just going to kill you. Because, you know, I'd recommend it to married friends. You know, I'd go, it's just very well observed. The people in the room are properly like, this is it. This is my life. I think there's a clip of yours online where you talk about someone coming up to you after a gig and saying, you're talking about my life.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it isn't great when you've got a woman crying. Going, you're literally describing my life, and I'm like, how depressing are our lives? Yeah. But no, and that's what I kind of liked about doing my show #NotAllMen is that it was a lot of guys who didn't want to come and that they had been brought there because their partners had kind of forced them to come along. But it is kind of creating that relationship with guys in the audience, and it's nice when also you can recognise there isn't just an attack on men in the household. It's actually an attack on both, you know, how we've all been kind of constructed and how our relationship with each other has been constructed. And it's actually, if you step outside of it, it's quite funny and ridiculous.
Yeah.
The kind of pressures that we put on ourselves in the, you know, in the home.
It's kind of, so would you say that it's kind of an attack on patriarchy, but unusually it's sort of, it gathers the men in a little bit more?
So I've come to this conclusion. I'm not a massive believer in that there's this kind of oppression that is wielded by men and women are the victims of. I think there is definitely a level of misogyny towards women, but I also think that men are victim of that as well. So when I see a guy who's particularly misogynistic, and I, especially now when I see it, you know, comedians and they're doing this kind of like ego thing of being quite misogynistic, it doesn't make me feel angry. I genuinely feel quite sad because I think it's a really unhappy way to live your life. And I don't believe it makes men particularly happy. So I think it's really important, which is why I wanted to address that in the show, that actually it's not an empowering thing for men at all. I think it makes them really unhappy inside. And I think, you know, the more that's addressed, rather than just constantly going on about women being the victim of it, it's like, yes, we are the victim of some unpleasant behaviour, but also let's start to address that this behaviour comes from a very unhappy place, not a happy place, which we also want to aspire to have. So yeah, I kind of started looking at it a little bit differently, I think.
So this is Esther. You can tell how relatable she is, not just in terms of her material, but also as a person. She has that quality that I think she shares with someone like Jade Adams, whereby you can hear already, you just in listening to that first however long of a clip that was, you probably feel like her best mate. I love that quality in people. It's great. So we're going to be finding out more from Esther. We're going to talk a little bit about growing up in Essex at the time of the Gulf War, with anti-Arab rhetoric prevalent in her school. We're going to find out a bit about that. We're going to talk more about comedy. And there are 15 minutes of extra bits and bobs, including Esther on her generalised anxiety disorder, all at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, where you can, of course, for the very small fee of £2 a month, or as much as you'd like to pay, it's entirely up to you, but everyone gets the same stuff. That flies in the face of accepted Patreon-style logic, but nonetheless, I think it is good. You can get ad-free episodes, extra content from every show that has it. You get the insider Q&As that we've had as one-offs with Nish Kumar, Alfie Brown, Fern Brady, James Acaster, as well as the incredible Self-Help for Comedians special. And I'm not really plugging anything at the moment, apart from there's one particular charity gig that I'm doing, which I think would be good to promote, which is in Bristol at the Old Vic on the 5th of December, Monday the 5th of December. That is for the Great Western Air Ambulance Charity, the GWAC. I see now that I've written it down as Gawk in my diary, but I know that it's GWAC because there was much hilarity about the pronunciation of GWAC last time. So if you would like to support people in need of being picked up by an air ambulance who live in the southwest, then please, and you should. I always like to support charities who can save me. That's a big issue for me. So come along to that on the 5th of December. It's at the Old Vic, which is as fine a place in which to perform stand-up comedy as any. There is something about the design of those old theatres, and the Old Vic in particular, which is just an absolute joy to play. It was great last year. I'm sure it'll be great this year. Come along, find out tickets for that by Googling for them. All right? Get over yourself. So we'll hear a bit more from Esther now, and I will speak to you in just a moment in my time, but to your time, for you, after the interview.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I saw a review that said, because it's got the title, hashtag not all men, you know, it's, I wondered if, like, there was, that says something. That might say, this is going to be, you know, like that could be interpreted as it's going to be a different type of show to the show it was. But I think that one of the reviews I saw, it said, hashtag not all men isn't the radical call to arms that the title might suggest. And I thought, well, I sort of see their point, but I think also it, you know, the title might suggest that, it doesn't promise that. And also it is nuanced.
Mm.
Like you're dealing with nuance. And what I enjoyed the empathy with which you're sort of saying, yeah, men suffer from this as well.
I think when people see hashtag not all men, they might think that it's either me saying, look, guys are really great, so we all just need to shut the fuck up, or that I'm going to be there and really laying into the patriarchy. And I think when people kind of see it come, they're like, oh, okay, so it's a much more gentler approach. It's like, well, it's not about being gentle, actually. It's just about seeing it for the reality that it is, that a guy who's assaulting women or being quite aggressive or misogynistic is not a guy that we need to hate. It's a guy that we need to step back and go, okay, there's something really not okay here. Mm. So what have we done to create that? It's just that kind of light-hearted bants. But that came from having a son, because it's all very well being married and having a daughter and going, right, fuck the patriarchy. And then you have a son and you go, no, hang on, wait a minute. You're going to be part of the patriarchy, so I need to start to look at what impact that has on you, and I don't really want to raise a boy. And I think now it's becoming really weird with guys, and I don't know if you felt the same, but I feel like there's a real shift with young guys, especially in like the clubs and stuff, and when you're gigging, there seems to be a lot more kind of agginess with kind of lad culture. It seems to be kind of, we have a little bit of a resurgence of the lad culture battling against the woke culture, and so that seems to be at this clash at the moment. So when you're going and gigging, you can either be gigging to very kind of woke lads who are terrified of laughing at anything and just like kind of nodding furiously, or you've got these kind of aggy lads who are like, oh, I can't fucking say anything anymore, yeah, and then getting really aggressive about it, and you're like, oh, this is a weird dynamic.
Yeah,
because then they never know how to react to you.
Yes, how are you navigating that?
Oh, it's a hard one, because it means that you've kind of got to get them on side really quickly, and that can be really tough, really, really tough. So I don't know. I've spoken to so many female comedians, and so many of them are feeling it at the moment. They're like, yeah, the heckling has gone through the roof, and catcalling, things that just weren't happening before the pandemic, where you could kind of rest assured that you'd go on stage. You know, we had a good couple of years, I think, before the pandemic, where things were quite calm. And so you could go and do the clubs, and you didn't really, you might get the odd weird night, but you didn't really get that much kind of. But now it's like, oh, every gig, we're going to have, you know, a guy shouting something out and just trying to rile up his mates. And it's just like, oh, is this going to happen every single time?
And so what do you kind of speculate is the reasoning behind that? Is it pandemic related? Is it the kind of rise of, you know, chauvinist TikTok stars? Is it kind of...
Oh, I've heard about this. See, I don't know about popular culture because I disengage in everything, well, honestly.
Well, I don't really either. So this is the blind leading blind.
I'm really bad, honestly. I didn't even realise Nelson Mandela was dead till about 4 months afterwards. And I was like, oh, was he dead? And people are like, are you mental? Like, I could have bypassed the Queen dying without, honestly.
I'm just going to cut out until 4 months after, so it sounds like you still think he's alive. That's where I thought you were going at the beginning of that sentence, like, until yesterday.
I honestly, yesterday I was recording something and everyone was talking about this guy on TikTok who's kind of basically saying, like, rape's okay.
Yeah. He's no longer on TikTok, but it took an uncommon bubble of national this is atrocious to actually get them to take action. There'll be loads of other people there that aren't in the spotlight as much.
But he will feed off hate. They'll all feed off hate. So surely these people don't need hate. These people just need like a little bus to go around, knock on their door, say, here's some medication. Would you like to talk to a counsellor? Because things aren't okay. Because that person isn't... Like, when I was hearing about the things that he was saying, I was like, okay, so he's getting the reaction. He's getting the hate. You know, he's probably getting a lot of women. Let's face it, because there is that weird relationship that a lot of younger girls have with kind of hyper-aggressive men, where they feel that kind of validates their sexiness. So he'll be getting laid. Mm-hmm. But it will come to, I mean, that's, he's not going to sit back as a 70-year-old man and go, oh, what a lovely life I've had.
Yeah, it's a tricky, there's so many layers to that, because like part of me, what I want to think is he doesn't really mean any of that. And I know with that, in this particular person, part of why he's so successful is he understood the algorithm very early on and went, he created an online club and got everyone involved to deliberately post clips of him saying the most deliberately outrageous things, because he knew that would spike the algorithm all over the place and get him more followers. Because
how old is he?
I don't know. And I don't know too much about it. And this is where we run into the danger of people who are uninformed. This is the big problem with podcasting.
Kill him.
Uninformed, speculating. But my point is, I always want to give people the benefit of the doubt and go, he doesn't really mean it. Well, he's just playing the algorithm. And then you go, some people are fucking horrible.
They are, but it's through removal of humanizing. And see, this is what I had with in my first show that I did, Crusade. I kind of tried to humanize the racists, and I was trying to break it down, because I genuinely think if you sat one-on-one with Tommy Robinson, I don't think that he, I think you could have a conversation. I mean, this is going down, but I think genuinely that a human bond could be formed. If you were, for example, locked in a room with him, he's not going to say, I cannot engage with you. But I think there's a way of dehumanizing people where it just makes it so easy to kind of spout hate online, spout completely disconnected hate. And actually, which is why it really messes with a lot of these guys' heads when they have daughters, because suddenly you've got this human form of the thing, and then you become controlling and mean and quite cruel, and, you know, in how they live their lives and the men that they might have relationships with, and then it fucks up. So it kind of has this knock-on effect. So you're probably right. It's all disconnected, and that's why he's done it. But I just, I'm not 100%, but the fact that he's got a huge following, it's not great. I wonder how many of those are female. Probably loads. Yeah. It's a bit bleak, isn't it?
I was just maintaining a pause there so that we could get out on probably loads. Sting, move on to something else, because I don't think either of us know enough about this. But I think as it pertains to your comedy and what you want to do with your comedy, in Crusade you were tackling, that's a premise, isn't it, to tackle, that's like a premise for a show. It's not just here's all my jokes, it's here we go, I want to tackle a thing. So in your get into the viscera of a social or a political or a personal kind of experience. It's not just like these are a load of nice fluffy jokes.
Yeah,
you're trying,
I wish,
to get your teeth into something.
But then I look at other comedians and they just talk about observations about the world, and I'm like, everything I talk about always has to be to do with me.
Yes, I'm the same. I would love to be able to write a joke that was about nothing. Yeah.
So I keep trying to like test material, and I'm like, oh, what's the deal with, I don't know, writing LOL, and people are like, what? Shut up. And I'm like, oh, okay, back to slagging off my husband and kids. But I'm like, everything I write is so like, if it happens directly to me, in relation to me, so friends, husband, children, parents, then I can write it down, I can cultivate jokes. But I'm terrible at just going, here are my observations of the world.
Totally.
And I wish I could do that.
I just want to pick myself up on saying jokes about nothing. I don't mean jokes about nothing, but you've articulated exactly it.
Yeah.
Some people can joke about things outside their own mind and their own direct
experience. I totally read you correctly. Don't worry. Totally. It is that thing, just like, because I sit and watch people and I'm like, I know nothing about you. So the amount of comedians I know nothing about, and you do feel it, because when you're talking about your family, and especially when you start to do slightly bigger things, and then people are commenting, be it positively, I mean, when it's positive, it's fine, but when they're talking negatively towards you, so people might write things negatively and they're like attacking you for talking about your family, and you're like, ah, be great just to talk about other stuff.
Yes, it would be nice to be sort of insulated from it. But I think what happens is, and I don't know if you felt this, when I started comedy like 17, 18 years ago, I was so naive about who comedians were. And I just thought, well, we're all good guys. We are the good guys, you guys, in a non-gendered way, because look, we've all done that very brave thing of stepping up to a mic and, you know, trying to make people laugh, and that's a good benevolent thing. And I had no idea that no, we're simply a slice, we're a representative cross-section of humanity who happen to be a bit choppy. Do you know what I mean? And a bit confident in front of a microphone.
Yeah.
So to kind of recognise that, where am I going with this? Whoever the latest person is, the latest comedian that people go, oh no, have whichever side goes, oh no, we've lost that comedian to the other side. You end up going, well, why did you think you knew that person to begin with? Because all you got, and this is the same in kind of art in a wider context. I think Alistair Beckett King said something like, we always, you know, we struggle to separate the art from the artist. Why were we thinking the art has any connection to the artist anyway? Why did we think that because we liked a story or a joke or a song created by someone, that must mean that they necessarily are the sort of person we'd get on with?
But I think people do think that they know you. And it's weird because they think they know you. and they will, or when they take what you say on stage literally, and then they'll want to have the conversation with you where they're going, yeah, because you said this, which means you think that, which means you and I can bond over this fact. And I'm just like, oh, this is insane. Like, I'm there telling a joke. Because if I was stood in the pub going, oh my God, my husband, he's done my absolute fucking head in, he'll never, I don't know, put the toilet seat down, I wouldn't then expect someone to turn around and go, yeah, let's both run off together and get divorces from our partners. You'd be like, that's a really intense way to read that. But you will, you'll get people who just read it literally and go, right, so this was directed at me personally. And you're like, no, I was speaking to a room of 2,000 people. And they're like, no, you spoke to me and now we've got this bond. And you're like, wow, that's a really intense way to read that. And you forget.
This doesn't happen to me so much. I must not be as relatable as you. Is this the double-edged sword of relatability? That people come up and go, you get me, man.
I once had a guy, I was doing a gig, and he was sat next to his wife, and they're in the front row, and I was outside, and he comes over whilst I was outside during the interval, and he went, I just noticed that me and you had a bit of, like, just a little bit of eye contact. And I was like, yeah, because, what? I was like, yeah, because I tend to look at people when I'm talking to them. And you were one of the 100 people that I was speaking to. And he was like, no, I just noticed that me and you had a little bit of, like, so I just didn't know whether that was like a thing. And I was like, well, unless I go on stage and stand facing the back wall, I was like, mate. And I just stood there and I genuinely don't want to say, I'm really sorry. And he was like, no, I just thought, you know, maybe if you wanted to exchange numbers, whatever. And I was like, no, I've literally just said I'm married with children. But the fact that I looked at you when talking to the room sent you very clear signals. Maybe go back to sit next to your wife.
Too relatable. Big problems. There she is.
Don't look at people.
Making eye contact with men.
I know. Like the whore that she is. Look at her. Out of the house, not wearing a bustle, making eye contact.
Something that someone said in a review was that, and again, I'm really bad at this. I keep like quoting reviews and I never name the writer, which is genuinely shocking. But someone said, and if you'd like to find out the writer, simply Google these exact words. Watching Esther's show made me realise how rarely you see a mum on stage discussing real life. And it makes me wonder if some comics censor this side of their lives for fear of having their identity reduced to, inverted commas, comedy mum. Do you feel that there's a fear of you being reduced to comedy mum?
Yeah, no one wants a mum. There are women, I think there are a lot of, this industry is the most anti-mother industry, and I felt it from the moment I started. I remember having conversations with an agent when I was looking to be signed in 2016, and their reaction was, they were like, you know, do you have representation? I was so excited to have this meeting. And then they went, you have got young kids though, so how far could you go in this industry? And that was my first like, oh wow, okay. And then, you know, don't talk about parenthood so much. And I, part of me was like, okay, trying to accommodate that, and then part of me just went, ah, fuck it, no. There's a huge, huge audience out there, and I don't understand why that's not tapped into. But there is a huge, huge audience of women who have children, who are maybe single parents or in relationships, but there are women who have money, who organise social events, who will go and buy tickets, and it's a massive market, and they're a fucking joy to perform to. Last Sunday, I opened for Celeste Barber. She's a Yes.
I was chatting to a mum in the playground about that gig. I'd never heard of Celeste Barber. She's like huge online.
Yeah. Women love her. I opened for her at the London Palladium. All women, just beautiful. And I was talking to Celeste and she was just like, but the industry so rarely wants to go for the woman talking about domestic life. They just don't, that, you know, and so she built it herself and she's created this absolute phenomenon. She's just selling out these huge arenas. And I'm like, women buy tickets, women consume. And it's the same with Joanne McNally. I mean, I know she's not a mum, but you know, you look at someone like Joanne McNally and she's just built this following of young girls who are going out and she's really homed in on that. And you're like, every single person has their following. And I think all trying to conform to this kind of you know, I don't know, single, you know, young. It doesn't work. It's great if you are that, but you can't pretend to be that.
It's incredibly short-sighted of an agent or anyone in the industry, any kind of gatekeeper-type position. I mean, it sounds like a very 2016 thing to have said. I wonder how many people are still making that mistake now. I remember, off-the-wall anecdote here, I was at circus school in 1996.
That's a sentence you don't often hear.
In it. we were doing neutral mask, right? Which is one of the build-up kind of mask work that then becomes physical theatre and what have you. And you wear this neutral mask, completely covers your face with nothing, totally blank. And what it does is it makes your physicality incredibly apparent. And I remember, as we were doing it, there were a couple of performers there who were punks. There's a guy covered in tattoos, kind of Mohican and stuff. And the circus, the physical theatre teacher used to get really frustrated with them, going, you need to be able to show a neutral body. You need to be able to sort of be anything and be applicable to anything. And this guy was going, nope, I'm pretty happy as I am, thank you. He's Norwegian. And he was covered in tattoos, had big sort of punk hair and what have you. And he went on to be incredibly successful in the cabaret world. Captain Frodo, if anyone knows the cast of Le Clique and La Soiree and people like that. And he went on to be incredibly successful because it turned out that even around then, in the kind of the early noughties, people really wanted... They didn't want neutrality. They didn't want people that could be anything. They wanted specific people to be themselves. Yeah. They wanted to go, this is you. This is you. You have a niche. People connect with you. And yeah. It sounds like that's exactly what's going on now with stand-up, particularly in a much wider way than cabaret. It's online and it's on Instagram and it's people going, there's a huge number of people out there, get your niche. And to think in 2016, someone was advising you to ignore your niche and not talk about the things that made you special is laughable now and will be preposterous 10 years from now.
Yeah. Well, I just think, like, you know, I mean, I don't know if I'll still be doing this in 10 years, but, like, I just think...
Again,
like,
that's a thing no one says. as your temporary agent, I advise you not to say that on the podcast. Except that, of course, you're being honest and genuine, and that is what people want to hear. Isn't that funny, that dynamic? Don't say this, they'll think that. Who's they? I don't know.
I just think, like, I've always felt like I've got a kind of very, because I've got a very kind of young energy, because I'm very energetic. I'm not someone who's very kind of calm, cool, collected, comes across as someone who's got this kind of like slick her shit together. I've got this kind of mania, especially on stage, and literally like just having this nervous breakdown, especially over domestic life, which I never ever thought I had. And I come from a really dysfunctional home life, and now suddenly I've got this 2.4 children, conventional husband type life. It's this kind of manic, like I'm trying to fit into it. And I think that is a niche, and I think it does work. And the more I lean into it, the more it's been lovely, because whilst it will get you a lot of resistance, especially from certain men, certain women, it does build you a really lovely, lovely following of just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful women. A lot of guys who maybe didn't want to come along, but then they enjoyed it afterwards and they'll come back again. And that's a following, which is so lovely. And you're like, I just want to build that up and build it up as much as possible. So I'm not really interested in trying to kind of play a game of pretending to be another thing, because it's like, I think it's really soul destroying.
Is there any ambiguity or kind of questioning that you have about who you are to an audience and who your honest persona is? That's one of the things I think, that's one of the ways that you can spot a newer comic who's going to do really well, is if you can look at them and go, ah, they're this person. And for some people, they, you know, like if you manage to kind of find your uninhibited, uncontrived actual self early on,
and I think
know,
it
finding,
takes
finding
a while,
your voice.
Yeah, it takes a while to find a voice, because when I first started, it was very much like, you know, middle class mum, and then you're like, okay, I need to maybe focus more, because because I live in a very kind of like middle class mum environment. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. And then it was like, oh no, more focusing on ethnicity and all the rest of it. And then I just thought, well, no, because all these things are applicable. And I did try and kind of push myself into just one neat identity, because I think this industry does fetishize just having one neat tick box. You are this. And when you're not, and I remember really early on having a conversation with somebody, which I won't mention who, but they were like, it would just be so much easier if you wore a headscarf.
Oh my god.
And they were just like, it would just be easier to push this, to push, you know, you talking about your ethnicity. And I was like, are you... I came away from that conversation. I was just a little bit stunned, but I was just like, but how would I even explain that? Like, let's say I was like, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, I'll do that. It's then like creating a... I was like, do you realise how offensive it is? Because it's not a costume. Like, you can't just put it on, pop out, do your little job, come home and take it off again. It's like, no, it's not a costume. Like, this is a belief. And also, I was like, how do I justify that to my children? Like, it's like, so at home you're having a bottle of wine, but at work.
Jeez.
And I thought, well, this is what the industry wants. It wants you to really neatly tick a box. And then the moment I just thought, no, I'm mixed heritage. I am a mum. I don't necessarily fit into any of those neatly, and I don't necessarily fit into it. And, you know, also, you know, from Essex and all the stereotypes that come along with that, I don't fit into any of them neatly. And that's just going to have to be what it is. I can't start conforming what I say and how I say it. And so the moment I rejected all of that and just really kind of let it be, it made comedy writing so much easier and performing a lot easier, and actually it made my relationship with people watching me so much better. So yeah, but this is back in the day.
What were the that's fascinating. What were the, when you mentioned the writing, it made the writing easier, it made the connection with the audience easier, because I think there'll be people listening to this who are still struggling to find their voice or still working on that, and it can take years and years, and even non-comedians people might be listening to this in any kind of creative space, kind of going, what is it that I do? So just talk to me a little bit more about the change in your writing and the change in your connection to an audience that came about when you made that kind of switch.
I think the moment I stopped going, how is this going to be perceived? So instead of monitoring what I said and how it would be perceived and how it would be read, the best thing was to go, I'm going to say what I want to say, what I genuinely feel, and the people that get it will have a really honest connection with me. The people that don't get it, they may get annoyed by it. It may just not be their cup of tea, but I'm just not for them. And the moment you get that into your head, you cannot please everyone. And I think when I started, I was trying to please everyone. And the moment you realise that you can't please everyone, but the ones that you do please will genuinely connect with what you're saying, because it's real and you're not faking it, then it becomes a real connection rather than this kind of generic, what can I say that will make a whole room go, ha? Well, what's better, to have a couple of people really howling and some people going, she's just not for me, which I did have in Muswell Hill not so long ago, where 80% of the room were just like, she's really gross and horrific. But this small cluster of women were literally crying and afterwards came up to me and they're like, when can we come and see you again? And I was like, OK, I'm going to take the positive.
Yes, that's great. That's better than 10 gigs where you do quite well to the entire room. That is better.
But sometimes that happens. You must find that in Edinburgh as well, where you have a gig and you absolutely storm in, you have a great time, and then you go and look at your Instagram, no more followers, and you're like, oh. And then you have a gig which you think is terrible, and then you just get four people from that gig just message you going, I absolutely love you, when can I come and see you again? And you're like, isn't it weird? Isn't it weird? It's almost, maybe they just feel sorry for you.
In terms of your... like, we've talked about accessing your true self in terms of kind of the your persona being honest and what have you. In terms of who that person is that you are honestly reflecting, and in terms of how that person was created, you mentioned sort of in passing quite a difficult home life as a kid, as a teenager.
Yeah. Growing up in Essex, and it was during the time of the Gulf War, and having Arab father, you know, it's a lot of kind of racial prejudice. Also, when we came over here, my dad being, you know, coming from a war-torn country and refugee and having kind of constant issues with immigration, things like that, just meant that you constantly felt very kind of outcast. And it was just, yeah, it was not particularly a kind of, not an easy time. Mm. I would say. So you just felt like you were constant. So it made me quite good at being a chameleon, I've got to say. Not comedian, but a chameleon, because it meant that you were constantly trying to shapeshift to fit in. Yes. And duck under the radar and not be noticed as much.
And is that the antithesis of the kind of true self stuff that we're talking about? Is that
probably
why it's so important to you? Because you've changed from being someone who felt they had to fit in everywhere.
Yeah. And it
and
really
now someone's gone, actually, you can be successful at an exciting job by doing exact opposite.
Yeah. But even in my personal life, like I remember like when I first got married, I was trying to really be like quite pleasing to like my mother-in-law, and I wasn't what she wanted as a daughter-in-law, God bless her. She wanted someone who was going to be a housewife and look after her son and put him on the throne that he deserved. And now suddenly she's got this, you know, hairy, loud comedian daughter-in-law. And it just made it so much easier the moment, because even in my home life, to just turn around and go, do you know what? I wasn't what you wanted and that's okay. I accept that. And it just suddenly changed everything, because instead of trying to please, when you suddenly just go, oh, I'm not what you wanted, but, you know, I'm here, it even made those relationships better. So it
did. Do you mean, when you say your home life, do you mean with your parents?
Well, with everyone, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
I say, yeah. Parents.
Yeah.
In-laws. All of them, I reckon.
Yeah, I don't think we've had that on the show, but I don't think the Gulf War has come up on the show before in terms of in terms of kind of the,
well,
you know, the,
I mean, because growing up, so I mean, you saw it in my show growing up in the 90s and the kind of anti-Arab rhetoric that was really hyped up on TV.
Oh, God, yeah, that bit was so funny.
So,
but
it meant like going to school where, and you don't think about it. I mean, like I was talking to a lot of my friends and they were like, I remember you getting a lot of shit, but I don't remember like seeing it on the media as much. And then when we were going back at like films that we'd watch, like Hot Shots with like Saddam Hussein, and all those things were so big then. And so Arabs were just these comical, disgusting.
It was totally acceptable to have a disgusting cartoon Arab as a baddie. Yeah.
Yeah. My teacher in front of the whole class said, in front of the whole class, just went, oh, will you shut up, you dirty Arab? In front of the whole class. Yeah. My religious studies teacher.
Oh,
and it was just acceptable. I used to get called, my former tutor called me a lazy Arab. Like, it was just this way of talking. So you got a lot of racism at school. And then I had this, so if I went home and told my dad, and one time, like, I did get surrounded by a group of boys and they were all, like, giving me loads of shit about being Arab. So, and stupidly, another mum saw it and she told my dad, and that was the worst thing, because my dad was like, I will go and kill them. So he's like driving around like screaming at them, which, oh God, still to this day I'm like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. But so I used to not tell my dad, because my dad would just explode, no pun intended. But and then you're like, that's that, because you're just feeding that stereotype, like they're all going on about you being savage and then you're rocking up at school and threatening to kill everyone. So you're kind of trying to juggle this world of like, I don't want, like, because my dad, he's the sweetest, loveliest man, but he's very loud and very expressive. And so obviously, you know, if someone's giving his kid shit, he's going to defend his kid. But it was just treading those boards, really trying to really kind of, and so you'd almost like try and anglicize yourself as much as possible at school. And then when you come home, you know, you want to kind of, because my dad used to always go on about, oh, you're losing your roots, you're losing what you are. So then you try and kind of Arab yourself more. And it was just, yeah, just, you know, so you become a bit of a chameleon.
Side note, have you talked about that dad threatening to kill people thing on stage? Because that is very funny.
Is it?
Yeah, it's really funny. Yeah, it's really funny. It's potentially fun. I mean, it's obviously rooted in something awful and difficult for you, which is why I'm into it as a comic. But it's also funny, I think, as a punter. Like that feels like when I think any time a comedian says this is the worst thing that's ever happened to me, a little light goes on in my head. Like, presumably there's a show in that. Do you know what I mean? Presumably there's a bit.
Oh God, no, I haven't talked about it on stage. Maybe
because
I will.
I think the stuff that you mentioned, like you handled the stuff that you just said to me there, that you know, the idea of your heritage and being picked on for it and the cultural context of it, a very funny bit in your show with these are all the versions, these are all the made up Arab countries that various TV shows have created so that they can have terrorists from there and, you know, so that Captain America can defeat them and the rest of it. Been very funny, and really for me just a genuine kind of scales falling from my eyes moment of going, oh God, yeah, I'd always thought, like as a teenager reading comics, I'd be like, oh, that's clever, they've made up a place. But really from your perspective, it's like, no, they haven't made it up. They've deliberately contrived a place based on somewhere I'm from. That's astonishing.
Yeah,
like I can't believe at the time I didn't go, fucking hell,
no,
that's
but
racist.
I didn't.
It was just one of those.
But I didn't as a kid. I just accepted it. I just accept. But it's with loads of things. Like, I mean, you do it even from. It's so weird how we develop and grow, because even I started rewatching Sex and the City the other day, just out of interest, because me and Lily Phillips were talking about it. And I was like, oh my God, I watched this in the 90s growing up going and not questioning any of it. And then you watch it again and you're like, my God, this is so problematic. It's just so self-loathing misogyny, just creating this kind of absolute hatred towards women if they're not validated by men. So it's all these things you don't notice at the time, but when you look back on it, you're like, God, that's not okay.
Hilarious fat Monica on Friends. That's the one that always sticks out to me. Like, she wore a fat suit to be a funny fat person.
But also that no one would sleep with her because she was fat. And she's not even really that fat.
Yeah.
She's kind of just this chubby girl. And they're like, so obviously no one would shag her ever because she's gross and disgusting and fat. And you're like...
So what I was going to say was in your show, you deal with the kind of relationship aspects of your mum and your dad. And, you know, you deal lightly with some of that stuff that now I'm sort of finding out is actually there was a bit more kind of guts to it and a bit more pain to it, I suppose. Does that strike you as, is there any part of your comic's mind that is going, I could get deeper into that? That might be an opportunity to get kind of deeper, more powerful stuff out of it. Or are you, or
when they're
are
dead,
you content?
I will go to town on it.
Yeah. I often think that. I've said this on the show before. I'm in awe of people who can really get stuck into their mum when she's still alive. I'm like, are you kidding? What?
I mean, I can joke about my dad as much. Like, my dad does not care. Like, people, I remember my sister coming to watch my show and she was just like, does dad know that you're talking about him walking around with his ball bags hanging out of his pants? And I was like, dad doesn't care. Because to dad, that's like... yeah, I didn't give a shit. That happened, you know, a harrowing first instruction to Neil. But, you know, is what it is. But if I was to get into their relationship, I think they would both find that incredibly uncomfortable. And I wouldn't want to say anything where it's going to make them go, oh, you know, you don't want to make people feel, I don't know. But
that's the thing, is it, as a comic, as a creative person, is that inhibition or is it just respect for the people that you don't want to screw their lives up?
I always think, because people have said to my husband, they're like, are you okay with how she talks on stage about you? Or I even had an interview recently where they were saying, but how are your children going to feel when they grow up and they hear the things that you say about them? And inherently, anyone who you have a very, very comfortable relationship with are the things and the people that you can talk about on stage. The people that you don't have a comfortable relationship with, like people that you're afraid to hurt, you can't talk about them on stage. So I think there's, like, for example, when you hear, I don't know, like Dara Brian talking about, you know, oh, we put all the effort into our daughter because our son's a lot more stupid. I can completely, completely get where he's coming from. And you know that there is a relationship in that household that has allowed, and that boy does not feel that at all. He knows that there is a running joke there, that the family and the context are completely correct. Otherwise, he wouldn't say it on stage. Anyone who you mock on stage, you have a really solid relationship with. And my kids know what I say on stage. And they say to me as well, I mean, we'll sat around, if they do something funny, they'll turn around, they'll go, Mum, can you not say that? Like, I know you're laughing now, but don't say that. And I'll say, okay, fine. Or they'll turn around and go, sure. No, that's okay. Like, my son's like, you can do the penis high five. That's fine.
But
don't do, you know, whatever.
See, I'm sitting here, I'm not squirming, but I am asking myself questions about, like, this is a thing. My kids are 3 and 7, nearly 4 and 6. And they're definitely getting to the stage. My son did a gig. He writes one-liners, and he did 7 or 8 of his one-liners to, like, 400 people at Camp Bestival. It was fantastic.
Kids to do stand-up.
Well, do you know what? The great thing about it was that he simultaneously had a really fun experience and... a proud dad. One of the best bits was that well-meaning parents were going "Ray" at his punchlines, and I was like, "Don't do that off stage in the wings." And then they stopped doing that because they started laughing. So I was like, "Yes, smash the gig, great!" But also, he had an incredibly level-headed kind of, "Do you want to do it again?" "Yeah, no, not really." Like, "Oh, that's the best!" He had a wonderful experience,
legend.
And it's also, I've inoculated him against becoming a comedian, so that's quite satisfying. But what I was going to say was, I'm not sure of where my kind of, I know where my loyalties lie, but I've been telling jokes about him since he was in the womb. And he knows that I've talked about him on stage, and I've done some of the stuff in front of him at a Comedy for Kids gig, but not all of the stuff.
No.
And I'm like, you know, I know that when he's an adult, if he looks back on the stuff as an adult, and some of it's available online and will be forever, I'm sure that he'll be fine with it. But if he were to look back on it when he's like 10 or someone, I mean, I might need to have a sort of a showing with him before a friend of his can find something online and show it to him in the playground.
See, I'm not worried about them seeing the stuff that I've said, because they'll know that. I think my daughter will be mortified. My kids will be mortified that I've done any of it. And I think I've been quite, like, they know that I joke about how much, you know, I hate being a mum and my kids drive me mad. So they know all that. But I think what will upset them more so that I'm worried about is the comments. That's what will upset them. So that's what I'm trying to pre-warn them about. Because their mates have seen, they have gone and Googled me, and they've gone, your mum talked about her vagina. Your mum swore. Your mum says that, you know, she just wishes that you and dad and stuff were all just friends and not related. My daughter's like, yeah,
that's
all that.
It's a great bit.
Yeah. My daughter's like, I know all that. She says, it like, this is a joke at home. But I keep saying to her, it's really important that whenever you see something about me online, you don't read underneath, because this is what, and I've had to explain to her what trolls are, and that they're people who are just really sad, and sometimes they may just hate you, and that's okay, but we just don't read them, because if you read anything, you're giving it life. So don't read it. It's really important, because I don't. And I'm, you know, I know certain things, but like, for example, people went and wrote stuff like my kids should be taken away from me and things like that. And that, I think, would mess with their head a little bit, to know that people think that your mum's like this absolute animal. That's quite hard, I think. But so that's more what I'm worried about, rather than the content itself. I mean, they know that you're, I mean, you know. They know who you are, and I don't think anything you say. I mean, I've seen your stand up. I can't imagine your kids. It's like I did a gig with Andy Askins and his daughter.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And I was talking to her, and she was going, yeah, no, you just get totally used to it. Because I was like, as someone who's got, and she's now doing stand up, and she said, oh god, Dad would say stuff on stage like he used to do jokes about wanting to murder my mum, all these jokes. And she said, but we just grew up with it, and because he would joke about it at home, we just knew the context. It never fazed us. Never fazed us. I was talking to Shappy as well, because obviously her little girl, and she's just like, yeah, if I felt like anything was too far with my kids, I probably would just remove it. But I do think the worst thing for them would be to look at what other people say about you. But
yeah,
we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it.
Soapbox opportunity. Now, Esther Minito, what are you doing with the show? Are you touring the show?
No.
Are you not? Should I take that question out? I assumed you'd be touring the show. Why aren't you touring the show? You've done the Apollo. You've done a great Edinburgh. Why aren't you touring the show?
I don't know. I kind of felt like I'd done it. So I've done, I did the show at so many festivals. I don't know what I'm going to do. But I'm doing a new, I'm trying to write a new show as we speak. I'm doing a work in progress on the 20th of October. And so far I have a...
Crack on, that's great.
Yeah, but so far I have a title. So if anyone can...
Oh, no, you don't want to tell us. No need to tell us your title. This
yeah,
no,
but no. I'm like, I don't know. Yeah, I'm. It's going to be about anger, and it's going to be very ranty. But that's as far as I've got. So if anyone wants to come to Woolwich Works on the 20th of October and help me write a show, please do. Come sit in the audience and just say to me, yeah, that's funny, or no, that's a piece of shit, and that would be amazing.
How do you do that? Do you write stuff down longhand on a printer? You know, do you print out a thing? Do you scribble in a notebook? Do you just write six words on your hand? What's the very beginning of the write a new show process?
So far, it's just jotting down ideas. So it's just jotting down ideas, and I'm trying to kind of get it into some kind of linear form.
At this stage already?
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't even know if I had anything at this stage.
I don't think I do have anything.
Have I got anything at all? Like, even that you've got, are you imposing the theme of like anger on the process because you want to talk about anger? Or have you got one or two bits that are about anger and you've gone like, oh, maybe this show's about anger?
No. I've literally decided I want to do something about anger and I've got nothing about anger. Oh, no, I think I've got one thing. I think I've got one thing. I can't remember what it is, but I've got one thing, I'm sure.
And the decision to do a show about anger is based on...
Just things that piss me off. And yeah, also that anger is still not considered a very kind of acceptable emotion for a woman to have. So if you're an angry woman, it's a really kind of ugly, ugly image, isn't it? So it's just little things that piss me off. So it's nothing kind of big, but it is literally just a rant. That's what I want it to be.
Yes. So, but the kernel of the idea is you think a thing and you're like, I'm going to write around this thing that I think.
Yes.
And construct it. And is that, because that's what obviously what you did with Crusade and with hashtag not all men.
Well, with Crusade, like, it's just all my material and just shoved into an hour. And with hashtag not all men, it started out like a book and then I had to make it funny. So when I first did it, there was just no jokes. It was like, this is the structure. And so people were just watching it like, okay, so that's a nice long story. And
do
then
you know,
I had to...
I've never written a show like that. I've always been intrigued by that, going, these are the all of the opinions and none of them are funny.
Yeah.
Like, I do that in stages. I do it sort of piecemeal.
Yeah, when I first wrote my... When I first wrote hashtag not all men, it was like, well, this is a nice book.
I think that's a good idea, because that stops you just coming up with wiffle. That makes sure at least wiffle. You mean everything that you say.
That's a really
good
word.
You just start off going...
what you just a think load yourself, of wiffle.
In September and October, I'm going to write a short book. And it's going to be short and not well-written, but honest. And then I'll start putting jokes in it.
Yeah. So you've got to find the funnies. And I think you can only find the funnies when you rant on stage.
Okay. So you're ranting on stage, meaning a thing, audience are there, super brain activated, but also you're talking about something you care about.
Yeah.
And then they laugh and you go, are you recording them? Are you making a mental note? Or are you stopping and saying to them, oh, you laughed, you like that bit?
Yeah.
Let's do that more.
Do a little tick. On my notebook. Worked. And then other bits, you're like, okay, you hate that, and that's absolutely fine.
How many goes do you give a bit before you give up?
I know you're supposed to keep giving goes. I don't. Because I think
one try.
Yeah, I think it naturally develops anyway. I think you might have a bit that absolutely smashes it first time you say it, and then you say it again, and it never, ever works again. So you've just got a kind of like... I mean, and also there are jokes now that I've been... Something went out on Comedy Central online the other day that I did, and I was like, oh my God, that's so shit. And then I was like, I still do that routine, but I've changed the wording, I've changed how it's delivered. But at the time, I was like, oh, I've just written this bit and it's really funny. And it's not. It's like, oh no, it's a lot better now. But obviously, it's gone out now. But yeah, so I think things naturally develop, don't they? And they kind of refine...
What things do you struggle with in your comedy practice? What do you see other people do and think, oh, Christ, I wish I could do that?
Oh, be funny. You know, you see people at new material nights and just whatever they say is funny. I never do. I never get that. I all my new material people are just like, I don't know what you're talking about. So all my, I can't do that thing of, I'm just going to write a list of loads of stuff and then go to a new material night and 90% of it will get laughs. I can't do that. I have to just literally take one joke and develop it at a time and just put it into my old set and that develops. So my set will change so slowly. You know, you see people and you see them like 6 months later and their whole set's completely different. I can't do that. I have a new chunk that's in there. And then come 6 months, there'll be another new chunk added on top of that. So if you compare my set now to a year ago, there's a lot of difference. But my God, it takes a whole year for my 20 minutes club set to change.
I think it's a good way of doing it. I've never really done it like that. But I think I've done a lot of... I'll open strong and I'll close strong and in the middle I'll take a lot of risks. And it's helped me develop as a writer in some ways, but in other ways I think it's made me less reliable as a...
No, I wish I could do that. I wish I could do that, but I just can't. I just don't have the... I don't know if it's the confidence or I'm not articulate enough, but yeah, I just... Yeah.
Where can we find you online? What is your preferred call to action, Esther Minito? How can we? Instagram?
Instagram and Twitter are the best ones. Okay. I think I'm on TikTok, but there's not a lot going on there. I don't really get it. Alongside that misogynistic man.
Yeah, right. I wonder if we'll look back at this in 10 years ago, because you never know which things are going to pop or keep going or what have you. But I think I'm on Twitter. That's the sort of thing. Years from now. Yeah. Are you happy?
I think so. I don't really fully, I think I've been happy for quite a while. I mean, if you'd asked me years and years ago, I probably would have said no, because I want more, or I want this to change and the rest of it. I do feel like I'm probably the most content I could ever be. So I don't think there's anything I'm kind of longing for. Just more babies in my life would be good, but that's not going to happen. So just got to push harder for my daughter to get pregnant ASAP.
Thanks, Esther.
Thanks, Stuart.
So that was Esther Minito. She has just such relatable stuff. And I don't know, I don't mean relatable to sound negative. It doesn't sound negative, does it? But I used to get really annoyed when people used to call me slick and people go, oh, I don't mean it in a bad way. Who knows what gets up people's noses? But her stuff is relatable, not in the sense that it's kind of blah, but in the sense that everybody can cling on to it, because she's just very, very good at zooming in on those little interactions, those little qualities of the human dynamic, and enlarging them for comic effect, which, let's face it, is a big part of the job. So find out more about Esther at esthermonito.co.uk. You can follow her on Twitter at Esther_Monito. But I see she got there first on Instagram, where she is Esther Monito. So find out more about her. You can find out everything that I'm doing by going to my Linktree, which is linktree.ee/Stuart Goldsmith, or visit comedianscomedian.com, or indeed stuartgoldsmith.com. In both of those places, you can join the mailing list. And I sporadically, and kind of almost once a month, and as someone said recently, it's quite nice that there's no rhyme or reason to it, because then it's a nice surprise. Well, at least you know that you're not going to get harangued by my mailouts, but they are quite fun. I have just, for editing reasons, had cause to listen back to some of this, and I've realised that even though to my ears in the real world my nose doesn't sound that bunged up, to you it does, and it's awful, so I'm not going to post-amble at you. I'm sorry, I'm just feeling too heady to do it. Besides, I started this recording several prime ministers ago, and who knows where we are now by the time you get to listen to it. No post-amble today. I will speak to you next week. Who's in the bag? Oh, we've got some good people in the bag. Won't tell you, because they're not in the bag yet, but they're in the diary. So there's two absolute belters coming up soon, and then I'm back on the booking mission. So you can look forward to... Oh, I'm looking down the list now. Dare I... Nope, I'm going to keep stum. So before we say goodbye, thank you once again to Esther. Thank you for listening, sharing, downloading, recommending the show to people, and putting reviews of it up wherever you see fit. And don't just put them up, but like go to platforms that solicit reviews and review the show positively, I hope. I mean, Christ knows. I mean, I'm awful and cringy and very nasal today, so maybe just get stuck right into me. So thank you to producer Nathan. Thank you to Moz for doing the logging. Rob Smouten did the music. And this podcast exists entirely for Brett Goldstein. We've got to cheer the little fella up somehow. Bye for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.